Hi everyone, and I'm happy to bring this training to you today from the 12th Circuit. I do a lot of the educational issues in our 12th Circuit, and one of the questions that we often get is regarding educational surrogate and the need to appoint one versus not appointing one and just allowing the guardians to go in and advocate in the schools, which they are already doing. So today's training is going to just take us through the need for educational surrogate and what Chapter 39 says about it and how we appoint and the qualifications and everything like that. So hopefully you guys can take that back into your individual circuits and look to see if we are actually appointing surrogates kids that are in need of them. So I'm going to start with the PowerPoint, and I'm just going to go basically through the PowerPoint, and then I'll let you know when to pull up that motion in order that I did so that you guys would have that too as well to use when you go to appoint surrogates. The first slide, I wanted to bring some alarming statistics that are pretty much easy to find out there across the nation regarding our foster kids and how they are doing in education. As you can see from the slide, foster youth who experience more placements are 15% less likely to complete high school when compared to their other peers. 24% struggle with disabilities. 52% attend schools that are ranked in the lowest 30%, and only 50% receive a high school diploma. Only 10% of those attend college, and of that 10%, only 3% will actually graduate. So what is a surrogate parent? Under Chapter 39.0016C, it's an individual appointed to act in the place of a parent in educational decision-making and in safeguarding a child's rights under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. So we're going to look deeper now into this. When the legislature designed this, they had a reason behind it, and they were hoping to achieve different benefits with this law. I'm not going to read everything off the PowerPoint because you guys have that in front of you, but if you look at those three items down below, that's what they were hoping that they could achieve, having high expectations for these children and ensuring their access to general education in the regular classroom. That was the first goal, and I'm sure if you look at your cases, a lot of our kids struggle with being in general education or having access to general education. Number two was providing appropriate acceptable student education with related services and aids in the least restrictive environment. So these are our kids who are struggling. Are they in the least restrictive environment, and are they getting the services that they need in that environment? And then having a trained, interested, and consistent educational decision maker for that child. And with our kids coming in to the system, that is something that they are greatly lacking. Foster parents do not have the time most of the time because they have lots of kids in their home, or if it's a relative, the same scenario, they're working full time. So these kids who are coming in don't really have someone that is set aside to be their educational decision maker. And oftentimes, too often, they fall through the cracks. Okay, so here's the requirements. In order to have an educational surrogate appointed, the first requirement is that the child known to the department or has a suspect, or is suspected of having a disability. And we're going to get into this disability on the next slide, but I just want to emphasize suspected. A lot of times people think that the child has to already have an individualized education plan and be identified under the IDEA statute in order to qualify for a surrogate. That is not true. A surrogate can be appointed if the child is suspected of having that disability, because a lot of times children who are delayed or could possibly have a disability that needs a plan, they need an advocate who is fighting and advocating for them in order to get that accomplished. So just remember that. It's not that they already have it. It could be suspected. Okay, so the next, oh, and something else that's very interesting in the state of Florida, I just wanted to point out that under, in the state of Florida, gifted students are considered under our defined disabilities. And gifted students also are entitled to an individualized education plan. Obviously, it's tailored much differently, but again, it is considered under our definition. So if you go to the next slide, I've listed out, and there are lots that a child could qualify in order to get an individualized education plan. So if they have any of these disabilities, they can get an individual education plan or an IEP, which is what it's often referred to. This is different than a 504 plan. A 504 plan is for medical reasons, not for known disabilities that have been identified under IDEA. So if one of our kids have something like this, they are entitled to that IEP, and those children really should, we should be saying, hey, do they need an educational surrogate? Okay, so second requirement in order to get the educational surrogate, no parent can be located. I'm going to talk a little bit about that deeper later on when we talk about our dependency kids, because oftentimes we can locate the parent, and so I often get questions, well, then that child doesn't get a surrogate, and that's not necessarily the case. The third requirement is that the court has determined that no person has the authority under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act to serve as that educational decision maker without judicial action. So those are our dependency cases. So we may know where the parent is, but let's say it's the beginning of a dependency case. We may know exactly where the parents are, but they are not in any way involved on a consistent basis to be the educational decision maker for that child. That does not mean that at some point during this case, as we go towards reunification, that parent won't become more involved, and then we can switch that role to them. The number four requirement is the surrogate parent must be at least 18 years old. Number five, have no personal or professional interest that conflicts with the interests of the student that they're going to represent. Number six, they must have knowledge and skills acquired by successfully completing training using materials developed and approved by the Department of Education. Those are the requirements. That's what has to happen in order for someone to be appointed as the educational surrogate. So the next question is, can I be an educational surrogate? Who can be the educational surrogate and who cannot be the educational surrogate? The next slide shows you, and all of this is being pulled from Chapter 39. This is on statute. Those who cannot be a surrogate are the following: an employee of the Department of Education, an employee of the local school district, a community-based provider. So case management cannot be an educational surrogate. Department of Children and Family Services, any other public or private agency involved in the education or care of the child, group home staff, and therapeutic foster homes cannot. Now, if you go to the other column, the first one that can be is a foster parent. So I find it interesting that the statute said no to therapeutic foster parents, but yes to a foster parent. So a foster parent can be a surrogate, a relative caregiver, a relative or non-relative adult who's involved in the child's life, regardless of whether that person has custody, and the court-appointed guardian ad litem. And what I find interesting is in statute, the court-appointed guardian ad litem is the one that is preferred. So that's why I really want us looking at our volunteer guardians and our cases to see, do we have cases where we need to be appointing the guardian as the educational surrogate? They are the preferable appointment under the statute. Okay, so before we go on to who appoints it, back under the requirements, I mentioned that they have to be trained. And I'm not sure how everyone else is doing it in their circuits, but in the 12th Circuit, we use the one county school board. So it's Sarasota County School Board. There is member on that school board who does all of the training. It is a 2-hour training, and she does it fall and spring, and our guardians can attend that, and then they get a certificate that they've completed it. Once they've completed that and they have their certificate, they never have to go back through that training. That's all our school board requires. And then that is accepted in both DeSoto and Manatee County. So that's how our circuit works, that educational requirement piece. I've had cases, though, where I've had a guardian and the need for that guardian to be an educational surrogate, but the guardian had not gone through the training yet. That may be a problem that you guys find, too, in your circuits. What we have done is worked with the school board. They have an online training, so they can open that up for that guardian immediately to do an online training so I can get that guardian trained. I've had guardians who've had prior educational experience, and the school board was fine with that, as well as the court. And when we get to the motion that I have today, the motion I did, this was an actual motion that our program did, the guardian had not been trained yet. So I wanted you to see how we worded that motion in order for the court to appoint them, and they still did complete the training that was necessary, but we were able to get them appointed immediately. So who appoints a surrogate parent? We know we have a need, we know this person has met the requirements, but how do we get them on this case? The district superintendent in your area can appoint them. If dependency is involved, if it's a dependency case, then the court is going to appoint them. And as I said, the guardian ad litem program will motion the court for an appointment. If the court appoints the surrogate, notice must be given to the child's school and school board as soon as possible.
No.
Okay. So let's move on. We'll come back to the motion and the order at the end. Let's move on to the responsibilities of the surrogate parent. What do they actually do? A lot of times when I do trainings for volunteer guardians, that's their question, because they're very active already in the schools. They're already advocating for their child in the school. So what's the difference? Why should I want to become a surrogate? So the responsibilities: must be acquainted with the child and become knowledgeable about his or her disability and educational needs. They represent the child in all matters relating to identification, evaluation, educational placement, and the provision for free and appropriate education to the child. They're going to represent the interests and safeguard the rights of the child in educational decisions that affect the child. So if you think of when you're at an individual educational meeting, the surrogate parent is the person that actually is going to sign that IEP as the parent. So in the eyes of the school, that surrogate is a parent. They look at that person as having the same rights and responsibilities as a parent would in school, and only regarding educational matters. So right now, guardians can go into school, they can get school records, they can go to meetings, but they cannot act as that child's parent in the eyes of the school. They can sign the IEP as a participant, that they were there, but they don't sign in the parent spot. And if they disagree with what's happening at that meeting, they can't really do anything about it. If you have a surrogate appointed and they don't like what they're hearing, they don't have to sign the IEP, which is what parents are allowed to do in that situation. The next slide says, it goes through how long does this appointment last. So there are different ways. I mean, it doesn't last forever, and it definitely provides flexibility depending on the situation of when you can terminate basically the surrogate parent. If the child no longer is eligible or is in need. So remember in the very beginning I said if the child was suspected of a disability. So let's say we have a child who was suspected of a disability. We appoint the guardian as a surrogate. That surrogate gets academic testing done for that child, and the result is they don't meet the requirements for a disability or an individualized educational plan. So we may no longer need that guardian to be the educational surrogate parent, so we could discharge. If the child achieves permanency, they're no longer in dependency. We're done with the case. We discharge the guardian as a surrogate. The parent who was previously unknown now becomes known. So we have now a parent who was unavailable. And remember, in dependency, we could start out a case with parents who need to go through treatment. They've gone through substance abuse treatment, mental health counseling. They're on the road to reunifying. They're at unsupervised. They have become very involved in their children's lives, and they want to be part of the educational decision-making. Then we want them to come in and be the parent in the school as well. So we would discharge the guardian at that point. The surrogate no longer wishes to represent the child or is unable. So if the guardian becomes unable to fulfill that role, we can discharge. The superintendent and the Department of Education, they can agree to that they no longer need the surrogate, and the surrogate can be discharged that way. And then again, this is the number one question I always get from the volunteers is, what if my child moves out of the county that I'm, like, I don't want to have to drive if I'm on Sarasota to Jacksonville because I'm the educational surrogate. Well, if the child moves, we would discharge. And hopefully we could look at appointing a courtesy guardian in the new area as the educational surrogate, because that can be done as well. The courtesy guardian can as well step in and be the educational surrogate, because we want the person who's actually going to schools to be the person who's going to fulfill this role. Okay, moving on. So the point of this is kind of to be like, here's the need, here's what the law says, and now are we doing this? Are we getting surrogates appointed for kids that are on our caseload that qualify? So I'm asking each of us to go back and determine the children that we currently already have. Look at the kids who are already in dependency and the ones that we already know have an individual educational plan, because that's really simple. If they already have the IEP, then we need to be saying, okay, we know that we have a child with a disability, child has a guardian, where are the parents at, who's acting as the educational decision maker? If there isn't anyone acting as that educational decision maker, then we need to be appointing our guardian as the educational surrogate. Then I'd like us to go back and look at the cases and say, okay, what about our kids who are just struggling? Kids coming in that are 2 and 3 years behind, that have been held back 2 and 3 and 4 times.
Can you still hear?
I don't. Phone. There, they went away. Remember that if the child is suspected of that disability, then we can go ahead and appoint the educational surrogate. Oftentimes, our kids are going to. And they need to have someone that is going to be advocating for that in their life. Okay. So the last slide is just a little thing from Dr. Seuss, because who doesn't love Dr. Seuss? Really just kind of addresses where I think my passion lies for these kids in dependency, and what I would really like to see us do statewide is to become more actively involved in helping our kids in education, because I do think they are very behind, and I have seen amazing work done by our volunteers in school. And now we have this amazing tool in under statute that gives our guardians even more of an ability to advocate. The schools are quite aware of educational surrogates. And so once you appoint your guardian as an educational surrogate and that school is notified, it raises the level of in the schools. Like, it alerts them. They respect that. They're aware of what this law says and the power behind it. So it's a very cool thing. If you want to pull up the motion and the orders, the guardian program is the one who's going to motion the court. The department doesn't ever, in our circuit, the department has never challenged us on this. Obviously, we have talked with the department and explained that we feel that there's a need and we're going to, you know, submit our motion, but everyone I've done has been an agreed order by all the parties to appoint the guardian as the educational surrogate. And I thought it would be great if you guys had this, and then you can just plug in the information that's relevant to your case into your circuit. But that motion, here's the thing, under the law, we have to let the court aware of what the need is. So we have to spell that out. We have to show that this is a child whose parent is unavailable. And we have to show the court that this is a child who's either suspected of a learning disability or has one. And in this motion, the kid that we did this for, she had an IEP, and like so many of our kids, she was moved. So she was in one county, moved to another county, and everyone told us, yes, the school records were sent. Yes, they got everything. It wasn't until the guardian traveled to the other county and had a conversation with the guidance counselor to determine that, what, we don't have an IEP for this child. She's not on a regular IEP. So here's a kid who had significant learning disabilities, moved, went into regular classes, and was failing every single one of her class. So when we found that out, we made sure we got the original IEP plan to the school she was currently at. But we had to show that to the court what happened. And you can see as you go through that, that's what we lay out. Then we had to explain why the parent was not able to be present. And in this case, her parent was in jail, and he was unable to be the decision maker. The mother was nowhere to be around, so we had to inform the court of that. We had to address, if you can, on the next page, you can see we had to address the area of that the guardian needed to be trained. I'm just making sure. Yep. And he had not gone through his training yet, and so we had to address that. We had to let the court know that he had not gone through the school board training yet, but based on all of the things he had done already and the fact that he was going to get the training done, the court agreed, as well as we let the school board know. So always let your school board contacts know. Work with them. We have a great contact in the 12, so every issue like this, I go right to her and I say, okay, here's the issue. We really need to get this guardian appointed. What can we do to make this happen? And then you can just put that in your motion and allow the court to be aware of it. To the order, there is specific things that you need to put in there, and that is listed on the second page under the it's ordered. And it shows you what the rights and responsibilities of the surrogate parent are, and it lists all the different things that they're going to be doing. And that one is the copy of the order is what's going to be sent to both your school, the actual school the child's at, as well as the actual school board, the county school board where the child resides, so that they have a copy as well as the school does. So that is, and one last thing, because I was getting ready to do this for this call, there, I got approached by our CBC in the 12th Circuit because on their JR paperwork, they have a spot where they have to address this. And a lot of our case managers weren't clear on what this educational surrogate meant or was, and so they asked if I would come and do a training for the case management team as well. So I did one, and I'm scheduled to do in the other two counties. But that's something else that I would encourage you guys to do in your circuit, is to reach out to your CBC because they need to be going through their paperwork and documenting it. But I don't think that they have a full understanding of what it is and how we appoint and why we would appoint, or that the guardian is the one in dependency that we're going to look to fill this role. So that is what I have on this. So if people have questions, I'm willing and able to take questions.
I have a question. As far as the parent unavailability, is there any case law or statute which details what would constitute a parent being unavailable?
I do not know if there is on case law. I just know under statute that it's up to the court to decide unavailable.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Okay. Thank you, Amy, for the very informative presentation. I'm going to cut the recording off now.